Session number 26359.
Colonel Robbins, Reel 11. So, you were told to take up the American positions.
Yes, and to repeat what I said about the Siegfried Line, this was in fact a line which ran along the east bank of the River Ruhr, which flows past Düren and Jülich to join the Maas at Roermond. Mostly, as I said, on built-up areas which dominate the open ground around them. I'm not trying to give the impression there was much of a line, but it was on a ridge which dominated any approaches to it. When we got to this American unit, who were unseasoned troops, I was very surprised at their general attitude, which was quite cheerful, but also you could see they knew nothing. And when I went up to a forward trench and asked where the Germans were, the boy in it said, about 100 yards over there, and then... And then he turned to me and said, are you an officer? I said, yes, sir. Yes, I am. And I'm looking at your company positions. Oh, he said, we never see an officer up as far forward as this. Which showed me the limit of their misunderstanding and knowledge so far of battle. As far as I know, American officers were not like that. But this particular battalion clearly hadn't, the officers didn't think it necessary to go to the front trenches. I said, well, all right. And I took over those trenches from them, and they crept out at night, and that was us. It was a very unpleasant, eerie place.
Were you in buildings, or was this out in the open?
Yes, there was a little village of Hatterath in which this man had his company headquarters. And I put my company headquarters in it. But, of course, it meant the trenches were all forward of the thing, facing the German lines, which were quite near. And... there was quite a bit of artillery fire, and at one point there was a little church there, and I went up with my gunner officer. But Germans are quite clever. They knew we'd have an OP up there, and they fired straight at this tower and knocked it. How we got out of that alive, I do not know. We fell down the stairs. Just another little part of not being careful the whole time.
Did you know what your objectives were? Was it just to push forward, or were they more detailed than that?
We knew that we had to capture this this line eventually, and that there was to be an advance to the Rhine. But it was all rather confusing, and I wasn't quite sure what the American army were going to do, whether they were going to surge down into Germany or what. And of course they did eventually. They went to Aachen. But as far as I am concerned, at my low level, we were just holding this area, which the Germans were resisting from. It was very, very boggy, very wet. And we moved from that village forward into a wood. And there was another rifle company, Henry Hoare D Company, in front of me. And they were dug in, and then I was dug in. And I remember saying to Henry Hoare, very careful of your feet. Don't let them get wet. He was a great friend of mine. And I also always remember he did let them get wet. And he got trench feet, which, of course, is a court-martial offence. I don't know how he got away with it, but he did. The only case I've ever met. While we were in this area, the colonel came up to me to discuss the situation, and I said, there are some German tanks in the woods over there. We hear them rumbling about. And I think they're going to assault. We're ready. He said, well, let's get in this trench. Three of us, my captain, him and me, in this trench. And suddenly, as I expected, the Germans started firing. Some tank fire with explosive shells, which they fired into the trees above us, which burst and splattered their shrapnel down on us. And that is what happened. I felt a frightful blow in the eye, and I leant back against there. And my captain, who was on my left, fell sideways into me, into my arms, and his head practically came off in my arms. A piece of shrapnel had cut his throat from ear to ear. The colonel on my other side, who was the tallest man of us all, was unscathed, I'm very glad to say. He said, well, if this attack's coming in, I think I had better be at battalion headquarters, and withdrew. I knew I'd been hit. No officers left. I knocked sideways. I remember feeling someone very gently putting something on my eye. It was almost as if it was an angel or a nurse. Where am I? I thought. I opened the other eye, and instead of seeing a beautiful angel's face or a nurse, I saw the grisly, battered face of Sergeant Jenkins, who was as gentle as any nurse I've ever known, as he bandaged my eye. I stayed on another day because no officers were available. I was in great pain, and eventually I was relieved and I was taken back. And at I was taken back to the forward, I forget what they called it, forward surgery or something.
Field dressing.
The next one behind. Yeah. Where there were doctors, and they looked at my eye and they said, you've got a shell splinter in it. And I'm going to operate. Now, I hope it's steel. I'll get it out with a magnet. If it's not, I may have to cut the eye out. That's the last I heard of it. When I woke again, I said, when are you going to do this operation? He said, I've done it. Here's what I got out of your eye. It was a piece of shrapnel, about 3/4 inch long, and a little millimetre or something wide, which had gone straight through my eye, and he'd taken it out with a magnet. But that finished my war, because I couldn't see properly, and I was sent back.
Were you very, very disappointed?
Well, as I said earlier, I was beginning to get bomb happy. I had been wounded, this was my third wound. I'd seen all my friends killed. It is a very funny feeling that overtakes one in that sort of situation. And I can't, if I'm honest, say that I was sorry to go. I really had had enough. I had lasted longer than many a company commander. It's time I was dead, is what I felt.
You must have been, in a sense, quite depressed. Was that not caring, you know, whether
yes, I think
killed is quite a function of depression, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I think, I really think it was extreme depression. And then to have this man, who had been a great friend of mine, my captain, he's much older than I am, but he was a very nice man. He was an Australian. And we'd been through so much together that to have him die in my arms was a nasty business. So,
do you recall his name for the record?
Stafford Crisps was his name. Stafford, C-R-I-S-P. I wrote to his wife. I never met her again. Never met her ever. By then I'd got used to writing letters to people, his wives.
You've been writing, I suppose, all the way through.
Always had to write. And always had to not make it look rushed. Always try and make it sincere. And that is not easy when you're tired yourself.
You must have had some days, had to spend really quite a lot of time writing those letters.
Yes, one did. I can't quite remember how much, of course. And what you must remember, Lindsay, is while I'm talking to you today, that I'm looking back so many years that my memory, I'm amazed at what I can still remember. I am amazed. And I know I've forgotten certain things which I should have told you. But I am getting on.
Yeah. I think your memory is phenomenal.
Well,
and I don't think anyone listening to this would know that you were 85, is that right?
Well, I don't talk about it, but there you are. Yeah.
It's amazing, the memories, yeah. So you were now officially injured.
Then I was injured.
Where did you get sent to?
I went to Brussels. And a doctor there said to me, would you like to go home? I could either keep you here. I said, for how long? He said, well, I don't know. You certainly, it'll be, you know, 6 months before you're able to function as a soldier again. Strangely, at this time, the V1s had already been landing in England in June 1944, and now the V2s were coming over, and we often heard them going off from quite nearby. And once I think I saw something going up in the sky from a distance. Anyway, I said to this doctor, well, I wouldn't mind going home. So I was sent to the Military General Hospital in Swansea. I think I was sent to the... And there was another one called the Queen Elizabeth's Hospital in Birmingham. And from there, after they'd done my eye up and so on, and I couldn't see anything. I think I had a patch on it for a while. I was sent on leave, home. So I was home really for Christmas. The home was in Leamington Spa, where my wife and her sister, who was married all to a sailor, Fleet Air Arm sailor, a very brave man, they had been moved out of London, where their home was, because of the bombs, and were sent to Leamington, where they had this house, part of a house.
How are you feeling yourself now? I mean, your eye was presumably no longer painful, is that right?
Well, it was very awkward. I couldn't see very well. I didn't know. I wanted to get back to the battalion then, of course. I was getting better. And after a month or two's leave, I was sent on a staff job to Chester. Still graded below active service.
Mm. And who were you with at Chester? Was this training?
I was with the command headquarters on the staff. Not that I did much. And that was a dreary business in Chester Castle.
And what were you actually doing?
I don't think I did anything. I was dressed up as a major. I was allotted to some department and used to sit in the office looking glum and asking when I could join my regiment. They got fed up with me and I was sent off to Colchester to a holding battalion there. And that's another day. Is it working? I was sent to Colchester where there was an extraordinary fellow commanding. And I asked, I'm not sure I should say this really, no I won't.
They're all probably long dead now, I mean you can say it if it has historical interest.
I suppose you'd like to hear it. I said to a lot of young officers, why are you so rude to the commanding officer who's in your regiment? They said, we don't like him. We were in Burma with him. And when we were told to withdraw, as you know, the drill is that the commanding officer is the last man out. He, in fact, was the first man out with his batman and his kit. And he escaped from Burma. A lot of us were captured or shot dead. And now those of us who are left find ourselves here. And he knows, we know he ran away. And it was a very unhappy holding unit I was in. One day I was in the lavatory and I was washing my hands and two or three of these young men were talking loudly to each other and they were saying, and then this bloody fellow, Serrano, his nickname, because he had a big nose, did this and then he ran away and God, what a swine he is, and he really ought to have had a bullet. And I said, why must you go on talking like that and so loudly in the lavatory? Oh, they said, we knew he was in one of the cubicles doing something else and he could hear every word. And we like him hearing such things. And he's too frightened to do anything about it. I kept trying to get back to the unit. And the war was still on.
What year are we in?
We are now in 1945. Mm-hmm. We're now in April 1945. I said, surely I must get back before it all ends. And how I got back, I do not know, but someone in the War Office must have helped me. Because the CO, the colonel, he said, well, you're not fit enough to go back. I want you here to train these men. And you will report here properly dressed. If you're not properly dressed, you will go back. He was making every difficulty he could. I got away from him. And I went to London. I saw my wife. I forget whether I was flown back to Brussels. I don't know. I got to Brussels. I spent a day or two there. I was slowly getting back to my unit, closer and closer. And they, by this time, were up in Bremen. And I think on the last day of the war, I got back.
That was to Bremen, wasn't it?
No. It was... they'd then withdrawn. The war was over. and they were withdrawn, and it was some village near Celle or somewhere. And, well, a great friend was commanding. He said, "I'm very pleased to see you back. Take over D Company." And that is that.
So how fit were you? I mean, what was your sight like then?
It wasn't good. In fact, it never has been good since. Although you can see nothing in my eye. If I put that, I can't see you. I can see my attaché case. I can't see your face. Because it went in there. So I can't see your hands.
Yeah.
I see my books over there.
Right, so you've got partial vision, just...
The retina's gone.
Yeah.
The retina, they said. Yeah. And therefore, I've got a disability pension on it.
Yes. Yeah. Do you think you were fit to go back in?
No. 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 But in wartime, friends and doctors and staff officers can do a lot to help you. They could see I was unhappy and they got me back.
What was it like rejoining the unit? I mean, they'd done quite a lot while you were away.
Oh, of course they had. And when we were there, the first thing I knew was the battalion was posted to Belsen, concentration camp. And I had in my jail, this was in Celle, my battalion had gone, they were some of the first infantry in there. I wasn't with them, though a few days later I was. And we saw all these dead bodies, thousands lying around. And the Germans all round denied all knowledge of Belsen camp. And eventually we forced the Germans and whatever German soldiers we could get to dig these long trenches and shovel the bodies in. And then our flamethrowers burnt down the gas chambers and huts. There was a barracks there into which the soldiers were put, and we had thousands of displaced people.
So when you got back, that had all been put in place, or were you involved in
it? I was involved in the end of it. And I had in my prison, before I moved down to Belsen, we were all dispersed, you see, the commandant of Belsen concentration camp, whose name was...
It'll be on the record.
Kramer, Joseph Kramer.
Right. So what was he like? When did you first meet him? Do you remember?
I met him in the cells. And he was in his uniform, and he was a man of 6'5", and he used to stand correctly to attention and say, "Jawohl, Herr Major, alles in Ordnung," he used to shout. And then I'd go and see the women prisons next door, and I said to Irma Grazer, who was the famous murderess in charge of the women, murdered all these Jews. I said to the interpreter, ask her if everything's all right. She screamed back a torrent of German at me. I said, "What's she saying?" "Herr Major, I dare not tell you what she's saying. If you don't tell me what she's saying, I will put you under arrest." "What she's saying?" "She says... Oh, Herr Major, I do not like to say this. She says they have not had a man for some time. Please, will you give them a man?" I said, "I have never heard anything disgusting. What, she'll get a bullet?" And left that dreadful woman. We hanged them within 6 weeks at Lüneburg.
The commandant, was he, it sounds as though he was courteous to you. Was that
very courteous, very correct.
Yeah. Were you able to form any opinion of him as a man? I mean, you knew what he'd done.
Well, I knew what he'd done, and I could see he was a pretty brutal character. I didn't like to spend much time with him. All I really wanted to know was that he was getting his food, that he had nothing with which he'd commit suicide. And I spent as little time as possible, but I had to ensure they were secure and well, kept well for the final.
Yeah. What was the attitude of the other ranks guarding them? I mean, were they... were you worried about them, you know, treating these prisoners badly?
Oh, no. No, they wouldn't ever do that. There wasn't any opportunity, really. Anyway, they didn't. They were cells, and there were German warders there as well, and British troops guarding the whole complex.
Had you had any inkling before Belsen, before the end of the war, say, that these concentration camps were operating?
Not a glimmer.
It must have been a huge shock.
It was a shock to everybody who came upon it. A great shock. Anyway, from there, I was then made the town major of Belsen for 6 months. And this was in a little village 2 kilometres out of the camp called Bergen. And the place is often known as Bergen-Belsen. And I had my headquarters there, and my job, and there were 2 rifle companies there, my job was to see that the curfew was kept, and to see that people didn't wander around at night disobeying the rules, looting, raping, etc. Very difficult, because the Jews used to break out of the barracks and camp where they were, and maraud German farms and kill and rape and take revenge. We then found ourselves protecting the Germans against the Jews. It was a very difficult situation. In the camp itself was a Hungarian cavalry regiment. And we had allowed them to keep their sidearms and their uniforms, because they didn't quite know whose side they were on. They were asked to guard Belsen, among other German troops, but they had a very odd relationship with the Germans. They were then our prisoners, and to my astonishment I found that I liked quite a few of them. The colonel of the Hungarian regiment was a cavalryman who was a very correct fellow. He had estates in Hungary and that sort of thing. And his officers were very nice. They occupied the village in which their families occupied the village in which I was, Bergen. And I didn't worry them. I let them live there. I let the officers have their arms still. They were no bother. They were like musical comedy soldiers, but terribly nice. He produced an orchestra for me from his regiment, which I used to have playing in my mess. He had some lovely horses, and he chose the best 4 for me, which I had in stables in Bergen. And he said, "You will have to have some grooms. Please have these grooms." So not only was I living in some luxury in this in the house that was occupied by the German Gestapo man, not Kramer, another man, I was comfortable in the mess, but I had these 4 horses. I had a very cosy life. The work was not arduous. And I think I had a couple of looted cars, 1 Mercedes and 1, none of which was, of course, allowed, but it was a time of laxness in one way and yet military discipline firmed in another.